This is True Crime Exposed, and I'm your host, Kayla Waters. This week, I'm joined by my co-host, Alicia Jenkins. Let's expose the monsters lurking all around us. Hello, hello, everyone. Glad you're here this week. We have a truly terrifying and very brutal murder to talk about today. It's one of the worst I've ever heard of, and it's based in Australia. If you're from there, you probably know the case, as it's infamous. But if you're from here in the United States, you may have never heard this story. So, are you ready for today's case? First, before we started, I actually did want to talk about this. Did you see that a suspect was named in Chris Tapp's homicide?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Okay, so it just came out yesterday. My father-in-law sent it to me. It's not really pulling up, but I looked over it earlier. It's a former congressional candidate and a wrestler and a father of six. He lives in like Texas. So random. I haven't read the whole article. Let's see. So he's a suspect. His name's Daniel Rodimer. And he was named as a suspect in the homicide of Christopher Tapp on Wednesday. Okay, he was a former Nevada congressional candidate. And then like after that didn't go through, he had announced he was moving to Texas.
And Chris Tapp was in Nevada when he died, right?
Yeah, he was in Las Vegas.
Okay.
But I, like, thought it would be a friend he was with or, like, someone he traveled there with. But this seems kind of random.
Did it say how they had a connection?
Rodimer and his stepdaughter, this is on East Idaho News, were guests at a Halloween party that reportedly included Tapp, an F1 driver, multiple social media influencers, and others.
Were there?
Yeah.
Okay.
A fun room was set up inside a suite bathroom at the resort that included lines of cocaine next to a $100 bill. Let's see. A witness told police rules had been put in place, one of which was not to allow Rodimer's stepdaughter to consume the cocaine. Wow. Let's see. A witness told officers Rodimer entered the fun room at one point right after Tapp went inside the room. And he said, if you ever talk to my daughter again, I'll effing kill you.
Huh. So he was maybe thought he was trying to hit on his daughter or something?
Yeah. Like, why are you there with your stepdaughter? And like the rule was like she couldn't get into the cocaine, but you guys are all doing it in front of her. I don't know. A little odd for me.
Not our lifestyle, so.
No, but.
We don't get it.
It's sad that Chris ended up dying there.
I know. After I know. All that he went through.
All he went through. I did think it would come pretty quickly since they already knew there was like a fight. I assumed a bunch of people were hanging out and something happened. So it sounds like that's the case, but I do think it's really random that it's just some random dude at a party in Las Vegas. I don't know. I expected it to be like his actual friend. But that happened to a guy here. Like, do you remember? A bunch of kids my age. I'd say his name, but he's out of jail now. But they like followed a guy after, like, who was at the bar, and he, like, it was him and his friend, and he had like a daughter. He was like in his 40s. These kids were like my age. They were like 18 at the time. A bunch of them followed him. He finally pulled over his car. They got out, beat the crap out of him.
I do remember.
He ended up dying. Only one of them went to jail, even though I know other people that were there. I don't think he ever named his friends. And then he's like out now and does professional video gaming. And when I see him online, I want to punch him. Because I'm like, you murdered somebody.
Oh my gosh.
Like, you murdered a father because you chased him down and like jumped him with a group of people. You just shouldn't be fighting and beating people up.
No.
could end like this. So anyway, for today's case, I'm curious to see if you've ever heard of it because, wow, it's a lot. I had heard of it, but I had never really gotten deep into it, and it is like horrific. It's shocking. So in 1988, John Charles Thomas Price was enduring the breakup of his marriage. John was nicknamed by his family and his friends as Pricey. And although a divorce is never easy, John was getting through it. He shared three children with his ex-wife. This is a son, Jonathan, a daughter, Rosemary, and a daughter, Rebecca. And the youngest, Rebecca, she was only about 2 years old when her parents split. So although the two older children, Jonathan and Rosemary, stayed with their dad, John's toddler stayed with his ex-wife. And it's tough splitting up a family, but they shared the children fairly well and they were getting through it. And then 7 years later, by 1995, John had officially moved on as his new girlfriend, Catherine Mary Knight, was moving in with him and his two oldest kids. John had been seeing Catherine for a while before she moved in, but their relationship was an affair on Catherine's end. She was actually dating another man when they met. This man's also named John. She has a lot of the same named partners, so that might get confusing. So she was dating John, and then she met John Price. But regardless of boyfriend John, Catherine and John Price fall in love. And although John knew the rumors of her tumultuous reputation, the heart wants what the heart wants. To him, Catherine was charming, and she also had a strong sexual appetite, which didn't hurt. And so he thought he found his person. And his kids also liked Catherine. She seemed to take them in well, and all was good for a while. But soon, John found the rumors around town involving Catherine to be true, because once problems started in their relationship, things became dangerous. Catherine may have been charming, but she was turning out to be pretty violent. And this came as a shock to John at first, but soon it became the norm. It's who he ended up knowing Catherine to be, and so he forgave her over and over again until it was too late to leave her safely. Sadly, in this case, the murder of John Price is so extremely bizarre and horrific that his story really gets lost in all of it. I found as much information as I could on John, and I'll end this episode speaking more on him and his life, but it was frustrating. Like, there's no information out there really about his life, his childhood. I would have loved to know how he grew up and where his adult life took him until he met Catherine, but that information just is not out there.
I don't think I have heard this. It doesn't sound familiar to me.
Well, you're going to be shocked. It is like horrible. It's like one of the worst cases I've ever come across. Yeah. So what I do know about John is that he was loved by all who knew him. His friends and family thought he was funny and terrific to be around. He was an incredible father who loved his children, and he was a good man. He was born on April 4th, 1955 in Gunnedahshire. I'm sure I'm not saying it right. This is in New South Wales, Australia. And I know he at least had one sibling because his niece, Shaylee, starts the Facebook page John Charles Thomas Price, aka Pricey's Memorial Page. And she uses this page to share photos of John and to honor his memory. And it seems like they all get, like, all his family that's still alive, like, gets together on, like, the anniversary of his death or on his birthday to celebrate him. And what was done to him is truly unbelievable. And unfortunately, we do have to dive into Catherine's background for you to really understand this case. Like I mentioned, she had a rough reputation around town, and you'll see why. So Catherine Mary Knight was born on October 24th, 1955 in Tenterfield, Australia. And she was a twin. Her sister's name is Joy. And the twins are born to parents Barbara Rohan and Ken Knight. But these two were not in a relationship with each other. They were each married to someone else, and they had an affair, which results in the twins. Barbara had been married to Jack Rohan, and Ken Knight was actually Jack's coworker. The scandal of the affair was big news in the small town, So once it came to light, Barbara and Ken, they get together and they move to another town. Barbara had four sons with Jack, named Patrick, Martin, Neville, and Barry. I don't know. And when she left to run off with Ken, she didn't take any of her sons, which I thought was weird. The two oldest stay with their dad, Jack, and the two youngest are sent to live with their aunt in Sydney, Australia. So she just, like, leaves. It's like, see ya, and she goes to have her twins with Ken. So after Barbara and Ken have Catherine and Joy, they do go on to have two sons of their own as well, named Charlie and Shane. But as their relationship went on, things were not good between Barbara and Ken. And sadly, the kids were brought into the mix, including the two kids that had remained back with Jack Rohan, because just about 4 years after the divorce, Jack had died in 1959, and the two kids were sent back to live with Barbara. So I think the two youngest still live with the aunt, but anyway, apparently Ken was a violent alcoholic who is alleged to have raped his wife, Barbara, multiple times a day. And then this information was passed on to her children because Barbara would tell her daughters, Catherine and Joy, about her sex life and the rape she was enduring from their dad.
Odd.
Yeah. She always included rants about how much she hated men. So clearly Catherine did not have a healthy view of men or sex since her childhood. And you would think a mom who has endured rape herself would be empathetic to her daughters if they happened to go through that. But Catherine had confided in her mom once about a boyfriend who she had who was pressuring her into sex acts that she was not comfortable with. And Barbara's response was to, quote, put up with it and stop complaining. So, like, not a great mom,
no.
In my opinion. Not great parents. So Catherine would often confide in her uncle, Oscar Knight, who she was extremely close with. And this must be Ken's brother. She looked up to him as he was a champion horseman, but she was devastated in 1969 when Oscar takes his own life. She still claims to this day that her uncle's ghost visits her. And obviously, Catherine has definitely gone through some trauma as a child. She also went through sexual abuse. She claims to have been sexually assaulted by multiple family members until she was 11 years old. And psychiatrists do support these claims because the information was confirmed by her family members. Catherine says it was not her dad who sexually assaulted her, but other family members. And it sort of makes me wonder about her uncle. Because she was, like, really close with him. Then he takes his own life around the time she's 14.
I was going to say, like, what family members? Like, her brothers?
Yeah, she never said.
Okay.
Yeah. But, and maybe it was her uncle, maybe it wasn't. I don't know. Maybe it ran in the family. It doesn't sound like they were, like, a very healthy family. So regardless, her childhood was not healthy. And as Catherine grew up, it showed. She ends up attending Muswell Brook High School. And although she was sometimes a model student who literally earned awards for her good behavior in school, she also had a bad reputation at the same time. Because while she could be well-behaved, if she went into a rage, it was really bad. She would get into fights with anyone who crossed her. She assaulted a boy with a weapon once, and another time she attacked a teacher who had to defend themselves, which then resulted in Catherine getting hurt. So ultimately, she's not having a great time at school, and she drops out at the age of 15. And she dropped out before she could really read or write very well, which, like, at 15, you think you would be able to read and write, but I don't think she was doing great in school up until this point. So she goes on to work as a cutter at a clothing factory, but by age 18, she landed her dream job, and this would be working in the slaughterhouse. Which, like, some people might really enjoy that, but it was her dream job.
I thought you were going to say, like, stripper.
No, not quite. Honestly, she might have been better off if she went to work as a stripper. This career is, like, what she would dedicate her life to, and she really enjoyed what she did here, so much so that she starts hanging butcher knives above her bed as a tribute to this job.
So is she, like, a butcher? in the slaughterhouse?
I think when she starts, she's not.
Okay.
But she might end up. I think she ends up learning
what
the trade. Yeah.
Become.
Because like when she first started, coworkers remember that she'd wander over to the production line and she would be like smiling as she watched like the pigs coming through, getting their throats slit and getting ready for slaughter.
I was going to say, I wonder why that was her dream job.
I know. Like her coworkers who were also working at the slaughterhouse found her behavior a little odd. Like she was enjoying it too much. You know, like I think a lot of people can enjoy working there and doing this job, but I think most people who are sane have like some.
You wouldn't be like giddy that
you're having to kill these animals. Yeah. Like I think you're more like thankful, you know, like thankful that these animals are producing food for us.
Right.
But she was like into the killing part. So, red flag. Now, while she is working here at the butcher shop, she meets David Kellett. Catherine was 18, David was 22, and he would become her first husband. They meet in 1973, and by 1974, they're married. Catherine alleged that David was an alcoholic, but she says that about almost everyone she dates, so just anything she says, I take with a grain of salt. I don't know how true any of it is. I do think a lot of the people she dated did like to drink. But it is, you know, because it is said that David did enjoy drinking and he would often get in fist fights. But it wasn't usually him who ended the fight. Catherine would stand up and end it for him, fighting off the other person herself. She was known around town to dominate David and fight anybody who ticked her off. So.
Okay.
She
don't
was
mess
like,
with her.
Yeah. She was intimidating. And at their wedding, David was warned by Catherine's mom, Barbara. David later testifies about what Barbara told him, saying, quote, "The old girl said to me, 'Watch out. You better watch this one or she'll effing kill you. Stir her up the wrong way or do the wrong thing and you're effed. Don't ever think of playing up on her. She'll effing kill you.'" And that was her mother talking. She told me she's got something loose. She's got a screw loose somewhere.
You're like, and that was her mother talking.
Well, that's what he said. I was still in his quote. It was him talking until she ends saying she's got a screw loose somewhere.
Okay, apparently.
Yeah. So
I wonder what she did like in her childhood.
Yeah.
For her mother to
for
think
her mom
this.
To be like, hey, she's got a screw loose and she'll kill you.
Yeah.
If you cross her, so don't. Which like the way her mom's talking, I think also kind of shows like her family, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't mean to say that in a pretentious way. Like, you can swear that's fine, but
just the way that
it's
you're
like the way she's talking at a wedding to the new husband, like, it just shows, like, I don't think they came from
like,
the
don't
greatest
mess
family.
With yeah. her. She's gonna kill you.
Like, I know
for
my
real.
Daughter will kill you. Yeah. It's just odd. Now, regardless of this conversation, David goes on to marry Catherine. He's like, her mom's a little crazy. And the couple shows up to their wedding ceremony on a motorcycle. They, you know, do the deed. They get married. They celebrate with family and friends. They're drinking. They're partying. And that night, Catherine wants to consummate their marriage. So they do three times before David falls asleep. So they do it three times. And then David falls asleep because he's a little drunk. He kind of passes out. And Catherine tries to rouse him for round four, but he's passed out. So the next thing he knows, she is on top of him strangling him. And this is how he's waking up. She's so pissed off that he is not waking up to deal with her that fourth time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, it was like a mad strangle, not like a
it was like,
sexual strangle. No, strangle.
Yeah. Not this is not like a kind strangle. Like this is not like a get you in the mood strangle. This is I'm trying to kill you because you're making me mad and you're passed out on our wedding night.
Oh.
So he fights Catherine off and he survives the attack. He's a bit shocked, but he blows it off. And the couple ends up staying together for 10 years. But that decade was not easy because Catherine perpetrated multiple domestic violence acts upon David. He was literally a battered husband.
And I know it's biased to think because you always think that the men, you know, abuse the women. And if a woman abuses a man, you would think they could stick up for themselves, mm-hmm. right? But like when men get in that situation, are they just like too nice to
Yeah, I think it's fight like back? More of like the mental. Like they're more mentally abused, so like they're convinced to stay or
Yeah. Cuz I mean, if I tried to do anything to Shannon, he could just literally punch me and I would
Oh.
Jacob get knocked out.
Could literally kill me so easy. Like he is like at least double my size.
So it's like, is it the man's just not reacting?
Yeah, I think it's like the man is being calm enough. Like the men seem to be good enough people that they don't like
know
fight
not
back,
to
but then they abuse keep, it a keeps woman happening to them. And then I think where the hard part lies is they keep going back. But just like with a woman, it says it takes a woman 7 times to leave an abusive relationship.
Yeah.
And like in a way, I think they're scared of her because she's so crazy. Like they probably could overtake her, but she's so crazy. It's like you don't know what she's gonna do.
Yeah.
Like I'll leave and she might actually kill me. So, for example, at one point, Catherine hits David in the face with an iron. Like an iron you use on clothes. It was hot. And this leaves bad burn marks across his face. And that evening, he's too scared to go to the hospital. So he secretly seeks medical attention the next day while he's at work. Because he didn't want Catherine to be charged because he was scared of what she would do if he turned her into the police.
It makes you wonder if she got physically abused as a child.
Yeah.
More than the sexual to...
Yeah. Or like if her... I'm sure... To me, it seems like her childhood all around was just not great.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't shock me. And then there's another time when Catherine's pregnant with her first child. David is out at a darts competition and he ends up making it to the finals. So this puts him home a little later than Catherine anticipated. So when he comes home, she flips out. Catherine is burning all of his clothes and his shoes. And they start arguing about it. She grabs a frying pan, hits him in the back of the head with it. David ends up stumbling outside into the neighbor's house before collapsing on their floor. And he's taken to the hospital where he's treated for a fractured skull.
And the neighbors.
And the neighbors.
Saw it.
Call the cops, take him to the hospital, whatnot. And, like they're like cops are actually involved, but Catherine ends up begging him to drop the charges and he does.
Oh my goodness.
So it's the same thing, just where people are convinced to like stay. It's like they kind of love the person. They think like, oh, this person just gets really mad.
Mm-hmm.
Until it's too late. So David, he was also not the perfect husband. He was not abusive at all, but he was often cheating on Catherine with other women. I like can't even blame him that much. Like you're getting hit in the head.
Usually you do blame
irons.
People.
Like to me, it seems like he's in a marriage. He's actually scared to leave. And he's probably like getting love from other people. Like, and then at home he's getting hit. Like he fractured his skull. That's severe. Like I feel like if a woman was getting that abused and she was sleeping with someone else, people would be like, okay. You know, like
yeah.
She deserves. Hopefully that guy helps save her. So, you know, I don't know.
In but this instance,
in this
the
instance,
affair is justified.
I feel like, you know, like he should have just left, but I think he was truly fearful. So I can't even really, I can't blame him. Obviously, Catherine is not cool with this stuff. So in May of 1976, they actually have their first child, Melissa Ann. And very shortly after, David goes on the run. He leaves Catherine for his mistress. And he, like, leaves town because I think he's too scared to leave Catherine and be in town. So he goes to Queensland with his... I'm probably saying that weird. He goes to Queensland with his girlfriend. And Catherine does not take this well. At the time, their baby was only 2 months old. And after David leaves... Catherine puts Melissa Ann into a stroller and she starts going down the road walking and she's violently pushing this stroller. Like she's throwing the stroller side to side. She's pushing her baby stroller into traffic and she's just acting very erratic. So she does end up detained during this incident, and Melissa Ann is sent to Catherine's mom just to be watched while Catherine is taken to St. Elmo's Hospital in Tamworth. She spends a few weeks here and is diagnosed with postnatal depression. Now, when she's released, she goes and she gets her baby back. But that same day, she takes Melissa Ann and places her on the train tracks before walking away.
Oh.
So her baby's just a few months old at this point.
Okay.
Can't move. Catherine then steals an axe out of someone's yard, and she starts running around town, swinging the axe and threatening all of those in the community. So she's swinging this axe. She's telling everybody in town she's going to kill them. All the while, baby Melissa, who is just a few months old, is laying on the train tracks. And this track has active trains. In fact, a train is approaching just a few minutes from the baby when a man from town nicknamed Old Ted is foraging nearby. Thankfully, he catches a glimpse of the infant and he rescues Melissa Ann from being ran over by the train. The baby is sent again to Catherine's mother because Catherine is detained and taken for another visit to St. Elmo's Hospital. But the next day, she's like, yeah, I don't need to be here. I'm fine. And they allow her to check herself out.
But do they give her the baby back?
I'm pretty sure she goes and gets her baby back from her mom.
Oh, boy.
Like, you just tried to murder your child.
Yes.
Like, had that twice. Random man not been foraging out there.
You.
In the woods, he wouldn't have seen your baby. Probably crying on the train tracks. He probably heard it. So then soon after this, she goes on another rampage. This is when Catherine takes her neighbor, Margaret, and Margaret's daughter hostage. She had told Margaret that she needed to drive her to Queensland to find David and his mistress. When Margaret is like, no, thank you, Catherine takes out one of her butcher knives and she slashes Margaret in the face with it.
Oh, wow.
Which Margaret, it's so bad, Margaret ends up having to get stitches. Like, she really cuts her in the face.
Wow. Yeah.
She's cray cray.
Yeah.
So, like, Margaret ends up agreeing, obviously, to drive her. Because she just got slashed in the face. And as they drive, Catherine asks Margaret to pull over at a service station for gas. During this stop, Margaret and her daughter bolt. They escape. And in Catherine's panic of her plan going awry, she grabs a little boy who is just there at the service station. And she takes him hostage, holding the butcher's knife to him. So, of course, the police are called. They come to the scene and it's said that they use brooms to attack and disarm Catherine.
Okay.
I don't know if they mean literal brooms. Like, if those were long enough, they didn't think she'd get the knife to
them.
She
couldn't cut them.
So they're, like, hitting her with these broomsticks. Like,
drop the knife.
And it ends up working, shockingly. She does drop the butcher's knife. And then she is detained and dropped off at the Morissette Psychiatric Hospital, which was the most notorious mental institution in New South Wales at this time. And while she's here, she admits to the nurses, like, yeah, I had Margaret stop at the service station because there actually was this mechanic there who recently fixed David's car. And I wanted to kill that guy because he's the reason David left me. Because if David's car did not work, he couldn't have left her.
Oh.
So she was going to kill the mechanic.
Oh, my goodness.
That fixed David's car. So authorities end up getting in contact with David. They're like, hey, your wife's going a little crazy. She doesn't have your kids or your kid. I think they only had one kid at this point. Like, your kid is with your mother-in-law. Your wife is in the mental institution. And she said she was going to kill the mechanic and kill you. And instead of being thankful that he ran from Catherine, David felt bad. He felt like this was his fault, so he decided to leave his mistress and go back to take care of Catherine. David and his mom go to the psychiatric hospital on August 9th, 1976 to check Catherine out and take her home. The couple moves to Woodridge, which is a suburb of Brisbane, and Catherine gets a job at Dunmore Meatworks in the nearby town of Ipswich.
She does love her.
She does love her slaughterhouse job.
Yes, she does.
Now, David later testifies that one night he woke up to Catherine sitting on his chest while he was asleep. She was gently sliding a knife across David's throat, and she starts laughing about how easy it would be to kill him.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, she, this bee is crazy.
She is.
She's a, I laugh because it's so uncomfy. I can't believe that
David stayed with her for 10 years.
I know. He was a battered man. It is
uncomfortable. I laugh, too, when I'm uncomfortable or when I'm in pain.
How are you this crazy? It is hard to hear that you're this crazy. That you're this crazy and you keep getting away with it.
Yes.
Like, why aren't you in jail? Why aren't you being detained long term in a mental institution? Because
her husband's not doing anything.
Yeah. It's, no one's really pushing back against her. True. So I guess Catherine liked to threaten David because he worked as a truck driver and she was convinced he was meeting up with girlfriends at every stop. And maybe he was, but like, you can't sit on his chest and slide a knife across his throat.
No.
Like, no. They might have a girlfriend, but in that case, then you just also have to be the not crazy one and leave. So the couple, they do decide to have a second baby together.
Ugh.
Natasha Marie is born on March 6, 1980. 4 years later, in 1984, all of a sudden, Catherine is like, I'm leaving you. And she leaves David, which, I'm not sure if he was like sad, but this was probably the safest way for him
to get out of it.
End.
I wonder why she left finally.
I know. Maybe she was just sick of the cheating. And honestly, I would imagine David was a bit relieved. Like, finally.
It's like, I've been trying to get you to leave me.
So Catherine takes the girls and she moves in with her parents for a bit in Aberdeen before getting into her own rental house in Muswell Brook. Just about a year after moving into her own home, though, she hurts her back and she goes on disability pension. The government also gives her a housing commission house back in Aberdeen. And the way she decorated her homes scared plenty of children. They were not usually allowed to come over and play with her kids because she would put plush toys in strange places alongside random farming equipment and different oddities. One of the most strange things was when she hung a scythe above the lounge room, which a scythe, I think, is one of those giant, like, knife things, like, on a stick. Like, what isn't that, like, what the Grim Reaper holds?
Scythe? Oh, I don't know. Like a, I don't know the name.
I could be so wrong, and people could be like, you're an idiot. I could look it up. Yeah, look it up. But she hung a scythe above her lounge room, which I think is like the living room, the place where you hang out. So it was a little odd. People just thought she was strange. And even while single, she still gets into trouble being violent. She ends up stabbing a police officer during an altercation, but the charges end up being dropped because everyone just knew that's just Catherine.
Oh my gosh.
So again, it's like nobody is pushing back. Like, the whole community accepted that when Catherine got mad, she was violent. Like, no biggie. Which is outrageous because she's had so many incidents that actually deem her unsafe. Like, she could have killed her kid. She could kill her husband. Okay. So a scythe is just like a super long knife. It looks like it sword. Has a hand. Yeah, it looks like a sword. Like a semi-curved sword. So she hung that above her living room.
Nice, I guess.
She just thought, and you know, people probably do hang swords and stuff, but combined with all that she is, it's weird.
Ugh.
Now, a couple years after leaving David Kellett, she meets another David. And this is David Saunders. Remember I said she did a lot of the same names? So we got David and David, John and John. So David Saunders, he's 38 years old at this time, and Catherine was 31. Saunders fell quickly for Catherine because she was charming, sexual, adventurous. And just a couple months after they start dating, Saunders moves in with Catherine. Although he still keeps his apartment back in the town of Scone. And this made Catherine seethe with jealousy. She was sure that Saunders only kept his apartment so that he could bring other girls there. She's so upset by this that only about a year into them dating, in May of 1987, she grabs a new puppy he had just bought, and she takes a butcher knife to its throat. She slits the throat of this 8-week-old dingo puppy right in front of him.
She's got a thing with throats.
Yeah. She's not.
An abnormal throat.
She is literally probably and the craziest woman I've ever
heard. Isn't it like, don't a lot of serial killers like start out killing animals?
Yeah, like anyone who's violent to animals is usually like a red flag, especially when they're like killing animals for pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that one guy. Have you seen that documentary? I haven't, but I listened to a podcast on it called Don't F with Cats on Netflix.
No.
This guy was like killing cats and videotaping it and uploading it on the internet. And like it pissed so many people off. Like these cat ladies online were like, like stop killing these cats. They end up like tracking him down. And in the end, he ends up killing a person. And he puts that video, I'm pretty sure, online. Or they end up, but all these people coming after him online are how he's found. But yeah, it's just a red flag when you start out killing animals.
Yeah. Like Ted Bundy. Like
you shouldn't get pleasure out of killing
animals. Ted Bundy's roadkill.
Yeah. Like it's just weird.
Yeah.
And it's different than like hunting. Because I feel like, I don't know. It's like the pleasure. If you are getting pleasure from it.
Yeah.
So when Catherine did this, she's screaming at Saunders that he should be scared to ever have an affair. And then she knocks him out by hitting him in the head with a frying pan. So remember, she fractured the other David's skull with a frying pan. So this is a pattern. And you would think the relationship would be over after this. Like you just slice. He had to have just bought that puppy. It's 8 weeks old.
Yeah.
Like that's like when you pick them up.
Right.
But no, they do stay together and they have a daughter together just 1 year later. In June of 1988, Catherine's third daughter, Sarah, is born. The birth of their child prompts David to move forward with the relationship even further, and he puts down a deposit on a home. The following year, in 1989, when Catherine's workers' compensation comes through, she pays the house off. And it's noted that in this home, Catherine decorates with her unique style. She hung horns and skulls on the walls, which, like, isn't super alarming. I have some upstairs. So I can't judge that because I have three right up there. So, but what was less normal is, like the rusty animal traps, the leather jackets, the old boots, the machetes, the rakes, and the pitchforks that Catherine hung on the walls. And she's what you would be, what you would consider a maximalist. People who like to decorate like a lot. Like I'm a little more maximalist style than like minimalist. Okay. I like a lot of decorations, but she's like to the max. Like she covered every inch of her home in these things. Pitchforks, machetes, knives. So it was a little odd. A little more than just someone having a skull and horns on their wall. So sometime after Sarah is born and the couple moves into this new home, Catherine attacks Saunders for a final time. She hits him in the face with an iron, and then she stabs him in the stomach with a pair of scissors. And for him, that was it. He was done. He leaves Catherine and he moves back to Scone. He does return to the home once to pick up his items, only to find all of his clothes cut into pieces. And it scares him. So he actually takes a long service break, like from work, and he goes into hiding because he was just did not know what Catherine was going to do.
Okay.
Months later, he's feeling a little safer and he's missing his daughter. So he comes back around to try and visit her, only to find out that he isn't allowed around Catherine because she had gone to the police and taken out an AVO on him, which is an apprehended violence order. Catherine had claimed that it was Saunders who was violent and that he punched her in the stomach during her pregnancy. She claims that this is why she slit the throat of his puppy. But Saunders disagrees with that story. And his ex-wife supports him by stating that David Saunders was a kind man who was never prone to violence. Okay. I'm going to err on the side of probably believing him. But, you know, who knows? Now.
So this is where she had two Davids?
Yeah. So okay. This was David 2. Yeah. And now he's left her after she stabs him in the stomach with scissors. That's why I believe him, that he probably wasn't the violent one.
Yeah.
Like, but she gets this out on him, I think, just to get back at him. And before she takes out the AVO, she had vandalized Saunders' car and then took an overdose of sleeping pills, which landed her back in the psychiatric hospital. So, yeah, she's on one. And then after her split with Saunders, Catherine meets John Chillingworth in May of 1990. He's 43 years old, and Catherine knew him from back in the day. She used to work with him. It's an old coworker. And with John, she has her fourth child, her first son, named Eric. Now, John was a recovering alcoholic, and he does actually admit to hitting Catherine once. He later testifies that he fought back after she smacked his glasses off of his face and broke the false teeth in his mouth.
Oh.
So he's like, yeah, I mean, I guess I did hit her. But, like, after she broke the teeth in my mouth. Which it's like, oh, it's hard not to be like, yeah.
I know.
It's don't hard be not breaking to be like, yeah. people's teeth out of their mouth if you don't want punched. So this is the boyfriend that Catherine is dating when she meets John Charles Thomas Price, the man I spoke of in the beginning of this episode. Remember, Catherine had an affair with him. And then when John Chillingworth finds out, she leaves to start dating John Price. And like I stated earlier, the couple moves in together in 1995. At first, him and his kids loved having her around. But when Catherine insists that they get married and John is hesitant, things get violent. Catherine retaliates to being rejected for marriage by videotaping things in their home that John had stolen from his work. She sends this video to his boss, and John had worked for this company for 17 years. It turns out the things John had taken home were actually out-of-date medical kits that he had foraged from the company trash can. So it's like things they had thrown away, he got recycled. It and like brought it home. But regardless, he ends up fired. I don't know if it's just like the drama with Catherine, all of it, but he had worked there for 17 years.
And is this John Price?
This is John Price. Okay. Yeah, so we're back around to him.
Okay.
We got David, John, and now John.
Okay.
Now, John's pissed when he gets fired, obviously, and he kicks Catherine out of his house. Like, screw you, you have to move. Like, because they're still dating. He just didn't want to marry her.
Yeah.
So she gets him fired from his job, but is like at the house when he comes home. He's like, bye. So months later, he ends up falling back into her trap and they do start dating again. Ugh. However, this time, John won't let Catherine move back into his home fully, and because he doesn't trust her. And it's also at this time that a lot of his friends kind of start pulling away because they really can't deal with the drama that Catherine brings. And they can see John's in an abusive relationship, and it's just too hard for them to be around Catherine. So they date for about 5 years, and then things get even worse than they had been. During a fight, Catherine stabs John in the chest. He is appalled by the behavior and he is scared, so he takes out a restraining order on her. It's February 29th that he stops at the Scone Magistrate's Court on his way to work. He wants Catherine to stay away from him and his kids. Now, I don't think he kicked Catherine out yet. I believe he was going to take out this restraining order first, then break things off. Because he does this right after being stabbed, like I think like the next morning.
Okay.
So she's still living there. And at work on February 29th, John confides in his coworkers that he is scared for Catherine to find out that he did take out this order. And he tells them that if anything happens to him, Catherine killed him. They urge him not to return home that night. They're like, dude, just come stay at one of our houses. But he has his kids at home. And he doesn't want his kids to be home alone with Catherine in a bad state of mind. So after work, John comes home, and thankfully Catherine is not there. She had sent his kids off to a sleepover at their friend's house. At their friend's house. So John, he hangs out a little bit with his neighbor and then returns home and goes to sleep around 11 p.m. After he is asleep, Catherine comes to the home. She makes herself dinner, she watches TV, and then she showers before waking John up for a midnight rendezvous. They have sex, which I'm like, John, kick her out now. But he just, I think, tries to appease her. He goes back to sleep, unaware that Catherine is super angry and has an evil plan. So the next morning, John's neighbor, who he also probably confided in about his fears because they hung out that night before, like I'm sure he told him, like, Catherine's not going to be happy. That neighbor is worried because at 6 a.m., John's car is still in the driveway when he would normally be headed to work. That March 1st morning, John doesn't show up to his work and his coworkers are immediately concerned. Their boss sends one of them to check in on John, and the coworker meets up with the neighbor. They're both outside trying to knock on the front door. They knock on John's bedroom window. But when there's no stirring inside the home, they call the police, who arrive at 8 a.m. By 10 a.m., crime scene investigator Constable Peter Anthony Musio arrives. It's Wednesday morning, March 1st, 2000. He is accompanied by Detective Sergeant Neil Raymond, Sergeant Bob Wells, and Senior Constable Michael Prentice. This house sat at 84th Street. Maybe their addresses are a little different than ours because this reads weird. 84th Street, Andrews Street in Aberdeen. And it was a single-story, three-bedroom home. The first thing Constable Musio notices is a piece of cooked meat laying on the lawn. That was odd, so he takes note, and then he enters the home with Sergeant Raymond. The first thing he sees when he walks into the kitchen is an entire human skin hanging from a hook in the doorway leading into the lounge room. This is not a body. This is the skin of John Price, fully intact, including his ears, face, pubic hair, genitals. Yeah, his black curly hair could be seen where the hook was inserted.
Oh my gosh.
And the skin hung from that hook with his feet resting on the floor. So that's the first thing they see when they walk inside, which obviously ties back to her job.
Oh yeah.
Like, she butchered him.
Mm-hmm.
And the sight is shocking, to say the least. The investigators' stomachs are turning as they move forward into the home to discover the grisly details of a very monstrous scene. It was in the lounge room that John Price's headless and skinless body was found. Catherine had been laying next to him when the police first arrived. She had taken an overdose of pills and was passed out, but arose and is like, "Oh, what's going on?"
Oh my God.
And she says she has no idea what happened. Like, she's looking at her dead boyfriend and is like, I have no idea what happened last night.
Skinless body.
Yeah. So they take her to the hospital because for her overdose, and the police continue to investigate the scene. Empty medication boxes sat on the kitchen table. Three boxes of Felodur. Do you know what that is? Felodur, ER, 5 milligram. One, like, it normally contained two strips of 15 medication tablets. One strip was completely gone. There was also an empty box of Prinivil. Do you know what that is?
Mm-mm.
This is also in Australia, so maybe they have different names for things. And Dapatabs. Anyway, all of these are empty pill bottles, part of what she had taken to pass herself out. In the hallway leading to the front door, Musio found a large pool of blood on the floor, along with blood-smeared walls that also contained blood spatter. As he moves towards the bedroom, there was more blood, but less than had been in the hallway and the front foyer. More blood leads from the lounge room into the kitchen and towards the oven. A pot sat on top of the cooktop, which was no longer turned on, but the pot was still warm to the touch. Musio lifts the lid, and inside he finds a pot full of liquid and vegetables, as well as a skinned human head. Catherine was cooking his head.
Oh my gosh.
She what a is psycho. Crazy. Isn't this the most crazy thing you've ever heard of?
Yes.
So this wasn't all that they found either. On the counter, there were two plates full of meat, vegetables, and potatoes. The plates sat next to notes. Each one of them had the name of John's kids. One read Beaky, is how it's spelled. Probably Becky is what it's meant to say. And one read Jonathan. I'm assuming Becky was like the nickname. I thought of Rebecca, but that's his younger kid. I don't know. And remember, there was also meat laying on the lawn outside. While a third plate had been prepared by Catherine, which was probably for herself, but after she tried the dish, she threw it out. The meat that was prepared on these plates was cut from the buttocks of John Price. She literally cooked him. She likely tried to eat it and threw out that third plate before planning to serve him to his own children. However, she was thankfully caught before his children could come home from their sleepover. Which, like, thank goodness, because they also would have seen
the mess,
this horrible scene. Like, what were you planning to do? Like, show them that their dad was killed and know that they're eating him? Like, I don't know what her plan was there. But thank goodness she is caught right away because his coworkers and neighbor were warned. So bloodstains were everywhere in this house. On the fridge, on the cookware, on the floors, on the walls. And Catherine had also posed John's body. Blood evidence showed that Catherine had dragged his body from the front foyer into the lounge room just 1 meter away. His legs were crossed at the feet, left ankle on top of the right ankle. John's left arm was then placed at a 45-degree angle. Under this wrist was an empty plastic 1.25 liter of Shelley's Club lemon squash, and his right arm was extended, lying alongside his body. Next to John's body lay a 31-centimeter knife with a yellow plastic handle. The blade was 17.5 centimeters long. And although John's body was skinned and exposing muscle and organs, stab wounds could still be seen that punctured into him. Those stab wounds were also seen on the skin hanging in the doorway.
Mm.
Like, you could see where she had stabbed him.
So that's, like, how he died.
Yeah. And we'll even get into, like, a little more of what the blood evidence shows, kind of exactly what happened, which is really sad. So next to his body on a chair was a honing steel, which I guess is like a sharpening stone for a knife, and a pack of cigarettes. There's also a broken picture frame containing a picture of John, and a handwritten note by Catherine is also found. The note was bloodstained. It also contained small pieces of flesh. And I'm going to first read the note how it was written to show how uneducated Catherine was. Remember, she dropped out of school, not really being able to read or write. And then I'll try to explain what people think the note meant. So it says, quote, "Time got you back, Jonathan, for rapping my daughter. You too, Beck, for Ross, for little John. Now play with little John's dick, John Price." What? I know. It's like, you just have to laugh because it's like, what are you talking about? So, time got you back, Jonathan, for raping my daughter. But it was spelled rapping and doter, D-O-U-T-R. So, she's saying, you raped my daughter. You too, Beck, I think is his kid. Like, she wrote on that note, Becky or whatever. Spelled it Beaky. For Ross, whatever that means, for little John, who's his son. Now play with little John's dick, John Price. So she's talking about John Price's son. Anyway, just a really weird note. But none of the accusations in the note were found to be true. Like, they did investigate that. I'm sure they talked to his kids, her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I don't know, was probably just trying to create a reason that she did this.
Yeah.
So, Constable Musillo said that based off what he saw at the scene, John Price would have been fighting for his life, and he would have been terrified. After discovering John's murder scene, Dr. Timothy Leons performed the autopsy. He finds that John was stabbed with a butcher knife 37 times, and once he was dead, Catherine skinned him by sticking a sharp knife just under his collarbone and slicing horizontally across the top of his body from shoulder to shoulder. She then removed his head clean at the C3 to C4 junction. Dr. Leon suspected that this whole process took Catherine about 40 minutes with her expertise. And remember, we know she made a career at the butcher shop, so she knew how to do this, and it was evident by how clean everything had been done. Like, she removed the skin in one piece.
Ugh.
It said like the only piece of skin she left on the body was a little square around a scar he had from where she stabbed him before.
Oh.
Like she did it on purpose. So the blood evidence tells the story of what John must have endured that horrific night of February 29th. After falling back asleep, Catherine had come into the room and started stabbing John. He wakes up and he does start to fight her off. Blood evidence shows smears around the light switch in the bedroom, indicating that John tried to flip the light on before running out of the room. Bloody handprints were seen on the walls as John had ran to the front door, using the walls for balance. And John did make it to the front door. He was even able to open the front door. He almost made it outside, although he likely still would not have survived. When he opens the front door, the screen door is shut. And Catherine must have caught up to him because blood trajectory is seen splashed across the front of the door. John then either stumbled back inside, landing in the hallway, or Catherine dragged him back into the hallway. This is where he bled out and died, before being dragged into the lounge room where Catherine skinned and decapitated him. After she killed John, Catherine goes into town, like casually strolls into Aberdeen, where she withdraws $1,000 from John's bank account through an ATM. She then comes home, she cooks part of his body, and then that morning of March 1st, she takes her overdose of pills and lies down next to his body. The days following John's murder, Catherine had spent in the hospital. She had been extensively questioned, but continued to deny that she remembered what happened. So on March 6th, 2000, police sat next to her bedside at Maitland District Hospital's psychiatric wing, and they officially charged her with the murder of John Charles Thomas Price. I would imagine that his family and friends were absolutely gutted by the news, not only that he was killed by his girlfriend, but the way that it had happened. The thought of what John went through was devastating to everyone who loved him. And what happened to him is almost unimaginable. It's hard to believe that anyone can do that to another human, let alone like the person's live-in girlfriend of 5 years. So Catherine was arraigned on the murder charge on February 2nd, 2001. She pled not guilty. Her trial was set for July 23rd, 2001, but her lawyer comes down with a bad illness and the date is changed to October 15th, 2001. Justice Barry O'Keefe presided over the case. Before the jury could even be chosen, he offers 60 jury prospects the option of being excused due to the nature of photographic evidence. Like, it was so bad. He was like, if you can't do it, you should go. And five do take this offer, not wanting to view the evidence of the murder scene. But just a day after the trial starts, Catherine says she wants to change her plea to guilty. Justice O'Keefe orders a psychiatric evaluation to make sure that Catherine understands the consequences of pleading guilty. And what the defense had originally planned was to defend Catherine by claiming amnesia and disassociation. The psych eval goes just fine, and they determine Catherine is of sane enough mind to plead guilty with. And with this, the judge adjourns the case, and they move on to sentencing. It's during this that Catherine's lawyers ask that she can be excused while they discuss the details of the case so that she doesn't have to hear what she did. Which, if you followed the Lori Daybo case, she did that.
Yeah.
Her lawyers were like, can she please be excused while we talk about the murder of her son?
And no.
The judges in Lori's case and this case are obviously like, no, you have to stay in here. So he denies Catherine to leave the room. And as the skinning and decapitation of John Price was being discussed, Catherine loses it. Whether it's legit emotion or a show she was putting on, I don't know. I assume it was a show to gain empathy or attention. But she goes completely hysterical to the point that the court has to sedate her.
Oh, wow.
Like, girl, you did it.
Yeah.
So stop. Now, family members and ex-lovers of Catherine had come forward to testify about her violent past. In the press, Catherine was described as looking meek and mild during her trial, like she could be anyone's mother. But there was a monster hiding inside. David Kellett, her first husband, testified that Catherine was, quote, unpredictably violent. On November 8th, 2001, Catherine Mary Knight is sentenced to life in prison without parole. He wrote on her papers that she is never to be released. This is the first time in history that a woman was given a life sentence in Australia. During trial, Justice O'Keefe said, quote, "The last minutes of his life must have been a time of abject terror for him, as they were a time of utter enjoyment for her. She has not expressed any contrition or remorse, and if released, she poses a serious threat to the security of society."
Yes, she does.
Yeah. In June of 2006, Catherine appeals her sentence, saying that the penalty she received was unfair and way too severe for the killing. Actually, girl, I don't think anything could.
No, I was just hoping you didn't ever get out.
Yeah. And any sane person disagrees. John's murder was savage and brutal. Justices Peter McClellan, Michael Adams, and Megan Latham dismissed the appeal in the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal that September of 2006. Justice McClellan wrote, quote, "This was an appalling crime, almost beyond contemplation in a civilized society." Catherine is still alive to this day. She's 68 years old, turning 69 this year, and she is serving her life at Silverwater Women's Correctional Center.
In Australia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. She's still there. Again, first woman in history to be given a life sentence without parole. And I think this was probably the perfect woman to be the first woman to receive that, because she is the craziest person I have ever heard of. One of them. Well, not craziest person, but she's one of the craziest women I've ever heard of. And then John, he was buried in an Aberdeen cemetery where his family and children still visit and honor him. His headstone reads, quote, "In loving memory of Price, John Charles Thomas Pricey, April 4th, 1955 to March 1st, 2000, age 44 years old, loving father of Jonathan, Rosemary, and Rebecca. Loved Poppy, brother, friend. A loving father is now at rest. For all of us, he did his best. His love was great. His heart was kind. A beautiful memory left behind."
Oh, I love the poem on it.
I know. So I know his family misses him. Like on the Facebook page, his niece said, like, she's wishes like that his story was told more, like who he was.
Yeah,
you know, that's why I kind of wanted to put an emphasis on him. Well, I wanted to put one on him anyway, but even without the very much information, it's like, let's remember that this story isn't about like just this crazy lady.
Yeah, I wonder how his kids are. Or could you tell if they were on the Facebook interacting or anything?
I couldn't. Like, there were basically just pictures posted, and it was like the niece and the niece's parent, whether that is his brother or sister,
yeah,
mostly commented.
I wonder if he's really missed. Kids, if you visit that parent that did that to your other parent, I mean, that was horrific. That was a gross.
Yeah. Well, they did not have any kids together.
Oh, thankfully, yeah. I was thinking they did. But the other John, the little John was...
So
meant for was with the first John.
Yeah, little John is like his kid, not hers. So like the plates she was going to feed to the kids were his kids, not hers.
Oh, okay.
She had four kids, but her fourth kid is Eric, her only son, and that's with the Jonathan before John.
Oh, but the little John is his
own kid. John and Becky and whatever. John, Rebecca, and
John Price.
Yeah.
It was his kid.
Jonathan, okay. Rebecca, and Rosemary.
So, yeah, I'm sure they don't talk to her at all.
Yeah, they definitely don't talk to her. Her kids, I don't know. I would assume you would cut that person off if she was that violent. I can't imagine that she was a very healthy parent to be around or be raised by. I mean, she almost killed her baby. So,
yeah.
I'd assume everyone has cut her off. I mean, her friends and family testified against her.
Mm.
So... yeah, I hope she is living a lonely life there in the Silverwater Correctional Facility. Thanks for listening. I research, write, host, and edit this show. My co-host is Alicia Jenkins, and all our music was created by Jaden Schultz, who you can find on Instagram at InPajamasMusic. Please, please, please leave us a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts if you have not. Share this episode or any other episode with your friends and family, and make sure to post on social media about our podcast and tag us. You can find us on Instagram at TrueCrimeXPod, that's TrueCrimeXPod, and on TikTok at TrueCrimeExposedPodcast. If you are experiencing domestic violence, help is available. Please call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. They speak English, Spanish, and they have interpretation services. So whatever language you may have as your priority, whichever one you speak the best, they can accommodate you. Again, that number is 800-799-7233. You can also text START to 88788.